It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we look at a provision in Governor Walker's proposed state budget that could eliminate state insurance coverage for municipalities and schools across the state. That's coming up at 3:30.
First, in the last couple of weeks, Wisconsin politics has been dominated by the ongoing right-to-work legislation and budget issues like major cuts to the UW system and big changes at the Department of Natural Resources.
But our next guest says those and other issues would be a surprise to anyone watching last year's election races. In a recent piece, he writes that this is turning into a pattern since Scott Walker became governor. Big changes that don't get vetted in the election campaign, starting with Act 10.
John Torinas joins us now. He's chairman of the company Serigraph, former business editor and columnist at the Milwaukee newspapers, and he blogs at Straight Talk from the Heartland. His piece, Do Wisconsin Campaigns Mean Anything Anymore, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be there.
Running up to the elections in November, we heard again and again in the media, on this show and elsewhere, that job creation was topic number one in the race. That's a lot of what the candidates talked about. How much have we actually heard about job creation since the election?
Well, I'm a little surprised that this number one issue in the campaign has gone almost dormant. You remember the first cycle for Governor Walker, 250,000 jobs was the goal. Got about halfway there, and there's a lot of work left to do. And, basically ran that he was going to get the rest of the way there. And Senator Mary Burke, who was running against him as a Democrat, also hit that theme really, really hard. They both produced economic development white papers, lengthy ones about job creation. And, of course, to my mind, it is the number one issue in the state and still is, yet it's almost disappeared from the rhetoric, from the substance of what the legislature is dealing with.
So on the other hand, you see a mismatch in what has been front and center, in the controversial issues. What kind of issues are you looking at that we're seeing now that you wish we'd been talking about in that election race?
Well, I wonder if voters would have voted differently if they knew that that Governor Walker and the GOP legislature were going to mess around with our two biggest assets in the state. And I would say those are our natural resources on the one hand and our great university system on the other hand. There was not much indication in the campaign from either side that we were going to fundamentally reorganize how we manage natural resources and fundamentally reorganize how we manage our great university.
Do you see this?
Not knowing, if you had known that beforehand, would you have voted the same way?
Do you see this as a pattern going back to the governor's first term?
Yes, and I also see it as a pattern of going back even in the last administration, the Doyle administration. It seems that there's more of a cloistered, defensive approach to politics in inside the Beltway. You know, a small group of insiders are coming up with these major policy shifts that... And little signal was given to the citizens of the state, and that is sort of contrary to the long history of Wisconsin, which revolves around the Wisconsin idea, which essentially means that the citizens of the state get involved in the dialogue and the debate and the strategic directions of the state. And now it's more a bunch of smart guys in a room making all the big calls. In business, there's an old adage that says, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in big trouble. Point is, you need to listen hard to intelligent people and get some intelligent thought before you make major structural changes in how you're doing business.
Now, you're not necessarily opposed to the content of all of these changes. You've written in support of many aspects of Act 10 in the past. You're more worried about the way these things are being done.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, this is sort of a process argument, but as you know, process can lead to product and content. The way we do things always or sometimes has a great effect on how we end up doing them. So it's not an abstract argument to say that an absence of dialogue, an absence of education of the citizenry doesn't have some kind of an impact on what kind of solutions we come up with. We're about to massively reorganize how the university is run. And if you do that, if it's a rush job through a budget process in the legislature, instead of a deliberate, strategic, studious, deep-running analysis of what the university ought to look like going forward, you're probably going to come up with some bad answers.
Yeah, you write that, quote, the governor must figure that government by lightning bolts from the mountaintop is the only way to get traction on large, intractable issues. So let's take that university system reform. If there's a notion that this should change, what is the right way to do it? What would you like to have seen the governor say do to approach this issue?
Well, first of all, I would have liked to see him raise it in the campaign, and let's have a debate about it during the campaign. Secondly, if you believe in the Wisconsin idea, you would have probably pulled together some kind of a task force or commission. Tommy Thompson did it all the time. He had multiple commissions going on simultaneously on major policy issues, and he'd get the best and the brightest thinking in the state, pull it together, and then they would, you know, sift and winnow, which is the Wisconsin idea, the facts and the challenges and the external and internal environments, and they'd come up with recommendations, and he would pick them up and run with the ones that he agreed with. So I would have liked to have seen that kind of dialogue. You know, there's another old reality in running organizations, and that is you don't give the people responsibility for running an organization without giving them the authority to do so. It looks to me like this authority, this UW authority that's being proposed, is all about passing off the responsibility, but meanwhile withholding a good deal of the authority in the hands of the existing powers that be.
So you also have called this government by surprise, but, you know, Governor Walker won elections three times now, big wins for the Republicans in the legislature. Doesn't that give them some latitude for making big changes, even if they're not the things that were talked about in the election campaign?
Well, Rob, you can make an argument for a surprise initiative. You know, for instance, Act 10. You know, almost nobody knew about that was coming down. I think we'd all agree it was a monumental shift in the politics and governance of the state. It basically neutered the public sector unions as a force in state politics. They're still there, but they're a shadow of their former self. And nobody saw it coming. Now, arguably, if that had been brought up during the previous campaign, the campaign of 2010, it might have gotten beaten down and not passed. So that's a very stubborn set of forces at work there, and perhaps the only way to go about that is to come on it fast and hard. Now, occasionally, and I live in the world of business, occasionally you'll do that in business when you have a crisis on your hands, and you have to make very quick executive kinds of turnaround decisions. But I don't think that's the case with the university. It may have been the case with public union power getting overwhelmingly strong in the Capitol, and some kind of a pushback was necessary. But you certainly can't make that argument about the university authority. You certainly can't make that argument about stewardship being zeroed out.
John Torinos is with us. We're talking about his recent piece, Do Wisconsin Campaigns Mean Anything Anymore? We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page. He says Governor Walker has dropped major policy surprises without previewing them in his election campaigns.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think Governor Walker is practicing what our guest calls government by surprise? Or do you think his election wins and the Republican majorities in the legislature give him the leeway to introduce major changes, even if they weren't brought up on the campaign trail? We continue our conversation now with John Torinos. He says Governor Walker is showing a pattern, making big policy changes without putting them in the public eye while he's up for election.
You can join the conversation. Do you agree that this is a pattern and that it's a problem? Why didn't issues like right-to-work laws, university budget cuts, changes at the DNR come out during the election campaign? Does winning the race for governor and majorities in the legislature give the winner the latitude to shake things up, even on issues that weren't previewed in the campaign? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thanks. This is a long-standing pattern. We have to realize that since his days as the county executive in Milwaukee, he has a history of union busting and attacking public sector employees and public sector workers generally. We see that with when he was in Milwaukee with his Act 10. We see that with his getting rid of the Department of Commerce and replacing it with a sort of cronyism with the Workforce Development Board, which has lost millions of dollars. He does this after he's elected, but it's a pattern of conduct in a classic, might makes right mentality. He has the power. He justifies it by doing it. And it is a clear pattern of conduct since he was a Milwaukee County Board executive. Thank
Jim,
you.
Jim, thanks for the call. John, he's saying we shouldn't be surprised that we are surprised by these policy proposals.
Well, I think Jim is coming at it from a substance content point of view. He doesn't like the attacks on the public unions by Walker. I'm coming at it more from a process point of view, and it isn't. I'm not just concerned about Act 10. I'm worried about things like the Natural Resources Board. You know, that's been around for 88 years. Has served. I think has been bipartisan forever in support of the NRB board making rules, adopting the rules about hunting and fishing and, lower level kinds of decisions, and to just whack it, to just, strike it out and reduce it to an advisory board without any conversation across the state of Wisconsin. Yeah, we love our natural resources. The people who love Wisconsin love it because of its forests and its lakes and its rivers and ponds and streams and it's it's kettle moraine topography, and you don't want to go messing with 8 decades of governance experience without some kind of discussion about it before you do it. You just don't ram it through a 2-month budget cycle and change nearly a century of governance. It's just not right.
John, you mentioned that you'd seen this already with Democratic Governor Jim Doyle. Is this the new normal in Wisconsin, given a heated partisan climate? Is anybody going to take the first step to get back to the kind of bipartisan, commission-based, long-term process that you're looking for?
Well, I don't know. I remember, and again, usually it's a budget crunch that creates the quote-unquote crisis. And then they respond to this quote-unquote budget crisis with these drastic measures. So in the case of Governor Doyle, he jacked the personal income tax rate from 6.95% up to 7.95%. And it was a material matter because two-thirds of the corporations in this state are pass-through corporations, either LLCs or partnerships or S-Corps, and they pay their business taxes at that level. So in a state that was trying to be business-friendly and trying to create jobs, you had a jack of, 15% in the business tax rate, effectively, without any previous conversation about it. Governor Doyle never signaled to anybody that he was going to do that. So this, yes, it does cross generations, it crosses parties. I don't know what we're going to do about it. I think we may have to start thinking about some of the kinds of things that happen in other states and other countries, maybe more direct governance, maybe more referendums like California on big issues, maybe term limits, maybe open primaries instead of closed primaries, because this has gotten way too narrow, too cloistered, too inbred in how major decisions are coming down in this state.
Do you think the media has a role to play in either bringing these issues to light in campaigns or helping get that direct civic participation that you're looking for?
Well, I think if you sum it up, I'm a former journalist, and I love journalists, and I love newsrooms. But I think, obviously, the journalists just did a horrible job of fleshing out these issues during the campaign. And we got by with all of this standard rhetoric about small government and cutting taxes and job creation, and then of course then comes the inauguration and job creation disappears off the radar screen, and we get workforce development coming along, which is a derivative strategy. You got to have the jobs first, and then you do worry about filling them and educating people for the jobs. But first, you got to have the jobs. And so, you know, I don't know. I think we're going to have to examine how we're doing business in this state. It's gotten far too narrow-based in how decisions are made. We're a democracy, after all.
Do you think this mismatch between what happens in the campaign, what happens when it comes to policy decisions, briefly, do you think this may be breeding cynicism among voters?
Absolutely. I mean, if the campaign is just rhetoric about a couple of issues, and then those issues don't get dealt with after the inauguration, and all the major issues are either ducked or hidden, of course it breeds cynicism. You know, The Bully Pulpit is that great new book out on Teddy Roosevelt, and he traveled all over the country using the bully pulpit to educate people, to lead them, to guide them, cajole them. And, you know, you knew where he was going. You knew where he was trying to take the country. I think our leaders have an obligation to stand up in front of us and tell us where they intend to take this society, this polity, this economy.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was John Torinas, chairman of the company Serigraph, former business editor and columnist at the Milwaukee newspapers. He blogs at Straight Talk from the Heartland. His piece there, Do Wisconsin Campaigns Mean Anything Anymore, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Governor Walker's proposed state budget has seen extensive media coverage in recent days. One aspect that came under scrutiny this weekend is a provision to halt state insurance coverage for municipalities and schools.
The budget proposal calls for a shutdown of the Local Government Property Insurance Fund, which is managed by the state, currently insures some 970 local governments and schools across the state.
Joining us now is Kurt Witinski, Assistant Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
What could change if this provision we're talking about in the proposed budget is adopted and the state-managed property insurance program is discontinued?
Well, it would mean more expenses for cities and villages and school districts and towns and counties, and therefore the property taxpayers that help pay for that property insurance would pay more. This is a program that's been in place since 1911. And it offers affordable property insurance for local governments.
You sound as though you're convinced that prices will go up. What makes you so sure?
Well, we know the prices are going to go up regardless of whether the fund remains intact or not. The fund right now is underfunded. It doesn't have enough money to pay off some of the claims that are being made against it. And so even if the fund remains in place, premiums will have to go up so that it's adequately funded. And then if the property insurance fund is eliminated, like the governor's proposing, municipalities and other local governments will have to go to the private sector and obtain quotes from the insurance industry. And so far, most local governments have looked at the private options have remained in the local government fund that the state operates because it's less expensive. So presumably, in either way, in the future, premiums will go up for local governments.
Can you give us some background on this state-managed insurance program and how it's worked over the years until now?
Sure. So as I said, it's been in place over 100 years. It was originally created in 1911 to provide an option for local governments to obtain property insurance because none was available at the time on the private market, and it's continued to exist over the years. In the last couple of years, it's run into some difficulties in that in 2009 or 2010, the fund had over $41 million in surplus, which caught the eye of some legislators in the state capitol, and they thought that was a little too much, and worked out an arrangement with the administrator of the fund at that time, and it still is the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, to give back about $12 million of that surplus, $12 million in dividend, to participants, local governments. Of course, at the time, local governments were delighted to receive $12 million in dividends, but that also meant that the surplus that was in reserve to pay off claims was reduced by $12 million. And then about immediately after that, or a few years after that, there have been some rather large claims made against the fund by school districts and counties and others who experienced either, you know, catastrophic losses through fires or tornadoes or storms or something like that, and had damaged buildings, and they've made some claims, rather expensive ones. So the fund finds itself at this state in time, at least in 2014, according to the annual statement of the fund, that the insurance industry likes to use this terminology, a surplus. They have a negative surplus of $1.3 million, which means they're, you know, $1.3 million short of where they should be to pay off claims that they anticipate based on the number of premiums, the amount of premiums coming in. So the fund is in a delicate position right now financially. I think that caught the governor's eyes. I'm sure it did. And also, I'm sure private insurance companies have probably talked to the governor about their desire to have more access to potential customers like local governments.
And has the state-managed fund that's been around since, what, 1911, you said, put private insurers at a disadvantage in Wisconsin?
Well, I would say that the trend lately in the last couple of years has been local governments there are less local governments participating in the fund today than there was at its peak two or three or four years ago. So some communities, obviously, I'd say half the villages in the state have found property insurance on the private market and must have found better deals or were just more comfortable going with the local, you know, insurance agent that they were familiar with. So I wouldn't say that they're excluded from the market, but this is an option that we think, this public fund option, the state-administered fund, is an option we would like to see continue to exist. And one big reason is because we're fearful that some of our members are smaller villages that have older buildings that might not have sprinkler systems or be near fire hydrants, or for whatever reason are too risky for the private insurers to be interested in covering. And so they might not be eligible for insurance or at extremely expensive premiums. One beauty of the current state-run fund is that it has to accept any local government that wants to sign up and participate.
So just in terms of on the street level, things that you might notice if you were from one of these municipalities or schools, what kind of effect do you think people would see?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think these are one of the behind the scenes in the back office details that most citizens of Wisconsin cities and villages wouldn't even be aware. You know, where does a community get its insurance, and how much coverage do they have? I don't think most citizens are familiar with that or pay much attention to it. But it is obviously something that's important for every community to consider. And so on the street, I don't think there'd be any change in what people observe of their city government.
So let's say this provision does go through and this state fund for insurance is ended. Would, say, a municipality but a city have to have someone who specialized in risk management to optimize whatever kind of package they got for private insurance, or is this something that should be pretty manageable regardless of the size of the staff?
Well, I think so most communities in the state of Wisconsin, cities and villages, our members anyway, are below, say, 2,500 in population and don't have a lot of staff, and certainly don't have a risk manager on staff. So, yeah, they rely on their insurance agents or the insurance company that they contract with, or maybe occasionally consultants that would educate and recommend and consult on insurance issues. So a short answer to your question is I think most communities will be able to handle it without hiring a risk manager or staff to do this. This would just be one of the things they'd have to trust their people they contract with to provide insurance. And by the way, one of the things that our association does, we do have an insurance arm, and so is the county's association, and so is the town's association. And one option that we're looking at to fill the vacuum that might be created by the elimination of this fund would be to start to offer property insurance. Currently, we don't do that. Our the league's insurance company and the county's insurance company doesn't offer property insurance. We just offer liability and workers' comp and stuff like that. So it's something we might consider to provide that service to our members and make sure that there's property insurance available. We could offer that in the future.
And any other alternatives like that on the table?
Well, I will say this, that legislators are very interested in and have heard from local governments and school districts about the concerns that they have over the elimination of this program. So the first option we're talking with is to work with legislators to try and maintain this fund and take the steps that are necessary, realizing that it will necessitate increased premiums. So there are legislators that are interested in talking to us about this, and so that's our first goal and our first effort is to retain this. And then plan B and C would be to work with other local government insurance carriers to make sure that property insurance is available. And the private market will make it available and does make it available. It's just we want to make sure there's a number of options out there so there's competition and hopefully keeping prices affordable.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the call.
We've been speaking with Kurt Witinski, Assistant Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities.